Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Sight Side. I'm your host, James Hickey. As someone late diagnosed with both autism and ADHD, I know exactly what it's like to spend decades navigating a world without knowing what your hardware is actually capable of. Today's a milestone for us. We're at episode 4 and our very first guest episode. Joining me today is Jeannie Love. With 25 years of experience in special education and executive coaching, Jeannie is an expert in helping neurodivergent professionals stop fighting their own nature and start building systems for sustainable success. Today, we're diving deep into masking burnout and the reality of neurodivergence in the workplace. Jeannie, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, James, for inviting me to be here. I appreciate it. A little bit about my background is that I've kind of always been a nerd about people and how their brains work. My first degree in, straight out of high school was as a physical therapist. And when I follow sort of the path that my career has taken, it makes sense that really the kind of physical therapy I enjoyed doing was for people who had had brain injuries. So maybe a stroke or some kind of a, accident that had caused a brain injury. Because I'm all, everything that you need to do in order to figure out how to help them relearn how to live their lives is unique to each individual because of the wiring of the brain. And so if we move forward a little bit, I ended up in this rural part of Colorado, and I couldn't really do that kind of brain injury physical therapy work. And so as I was spending time as a young ski bum and working multiple jobs, I ended up in schools. And I started working with students who had learning disabilities. And for almost 20 years, I worked with students who needed significant amount of support to be successful in school. I also worked with students who needed a little less support to be successful in school. But as I kind of worked through that, I really mostly enjoyed working with students who had ADHD or autism. And I think it's because really all of this work was at the high school level. And when you're working with kids like that, it's like, how do we navigate this world? How do we learn how to play the game of school so that you can get what you want, which is good grades and a diploma and all of those things? And so how can we make the system of school work for you? So I did that for almost 20 years. Some of it, I had the opportunity to be in South America, which was really cool. And when we came back in 2020, I realized I needed to do something different because my daughter, who was 7 at the time, was having her own significant challenges, big emotional outbursts. And I realized there was no way I was going to be able to go back to public education and help other kids and also have the energy and bandwidth to be a good mother to her.
Right.
So I left teaching. And then I was like, oh, well, what am I going to do now? I am halfway through my career. I've got 20 years ahead of me. And I was researching and interviewing and all these things. And that's when I realized that there's a lot of adults who are finding out later in life that they have ADHD or autism.
Right.
And so I thought it might be something of interest to them to share the strategies that I've learned along the way. So that's when I started this coaching program. And so it's just kind of been an evolution since then.
That's amazing. Okay, so I wanted to ask you, so before you got into a special education environment, what was your perception of neurodivergence before you really came face to face with it?
I mean, this was so long ago. This was in 2002. And so there's just, I mean, if you can think about your age in 2002 or the listener, like what were you doing in 2002? There was just not as much information back then. I don't even know how to describe it. So we would have autistic students, but mostly they were like significantly impacted and struggling at school.
Absolutely.
Not the ones who are okay in academics, but struggling in other ways. So we didn't even have that back in 2002. So the understanding of neurodivergence was much different back then. It was, maybe the kid, the troublemaker boy who had trouble sitting still might have ADHD. Maybe there was an autistic misdiagnosis as ADHD. There was definitely dyslexia, but it was just like, we didn't have as much of an understanding as we do, now.
Right. Well, back then, because personally, I'm a level 1 ASD, which used to be Asperger's back in 2002, yes. 2001, and yes. Then they switched it And now it's considered level one. But I agree. You know, I graduated high school in 1998. And when I was growing up and going through all these things, I was always, you know, always struggling with scholastics. I was always struggling with, you know, with school, paying attention. You know, executive function back then was always a major, major hassle for me. And I never knew what was, you know, what the, you know, what the actual prognosis was. I didn't have a, no one saw me.
Yeah.
No one saw me. So this is, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to ask you on the show is because of your work with obviously late identified or later identified, neurodivergent people. So before we get into that, since you've seen both sides of the spectrum, as far as, you know, coming into education and seeing people in a classroom, obviously with your daughter being 7 years old and seeing what the emotional outbursts and neurodivergence there, what would you say, in your professional opinion, is the main difference between an early diagnosis or a late diagnosis?
I think now what I'm seeing as I have some younger clients who have known that they had ADHD for a longer period of time than my adult clients, they have a better vocabulary to talk about what their challenges are. I think that is now more understood. And so like where you didn't have vocabulary to describe executive function, your teachers probably told your parents in conferences, like he just needs to focus more and work harder and he's not living up to his potential. Now we have a vocabulary for that. And so they know themselves better. And so they know what they need to work on. So they're at a different starting point where my clients who are diagnosed later in their life, in their 40s, their 50s, I have clients in their 70s. It's more like, wait, what? Like, what does all of this mean? This is the, just like you, this is the thing that has been going on with me for this long. And then they just want to learn everything they can about it. And then that gets overwhelming because now there's so much information out there that they don't even know where to start. And so then that also becomes sort of a challenge that we work through, is like how to slow down and just get to know yourself. And so there's a lot of work that that we do with later diagnosed adults to just get to know yourself, your brain, what was maybe some masking that you were doing, how can we start to pull that, you know, peel that away a little bit, and then build systems that work for you. So the vocabulary and all of that, very different.
Right. It's a, yeah. You know, I've noticed through, you know, the more I get involved in the neurodivergent community, I've seen that there is a kind of a gulf there between the early diagnosis and the late diagnosis, mainly in what you said about getting, you know, scaffolding and structure. They get that sense of, I would almost say validation from, you know, from yes. peers, from teachers, people actually making, they might not understand, but they're sympathetic and they make that effort to understand and say, okay, well, maybe this is part of a larger, you know, neurodiverse, you know, you have some serious, you know, it's a serious diagnosis versus you just being like a one-off, like just a troublemaker, just a, you know, where they just kind of write you off, throw you in the detention, you know, detention or the, you know, acting out in school, going into like at-risk youth programs and whatnot. Or they just kind of push it off instead of now I feel that it's taken a little bit more seriously.
Yeah. And I think, too, that they're the community for people who now know. So it's like even my daughter, she's got books. She understands who she is. She runs into other people who have ADHD or sees it on, you know, social media or whatever. So she's a member of a community where later diagnosed people didn't get that when they were young.
Right. I, you know, and I can relate to that. Personally, as a late diagnosed person myself, it mostly gave me a lens. It gave me a lot of clarity. You know, I would think back to different situations I've been in my life. And I'm like, well, why did I do that? Well, obviously, you know, autism. That's why, you know, it's just like, okay, you didn't know what I was dealing with. And you mentioned earlier about, you know, masking. And that's one of the things that I dealt with during our introductory talk. We got into a little bit about the substance use disorder, which is, you know, very rampant in the ADHD, autism, I would say neurodiverse community at large. It's something that's not really talked about too much. And personally, I used it as a means of, you know, cognitive regulation. I wasn't necessarily using for escape. It was just it made things a lot more bearable, I guess. So I just wanted to mention that, because is that something that you run into more with the late diagnosed, or do you find with like early diagnosed people, maybe they're asking questions about it?
I guess I would say, like, let's just go ahead and say here that, like, most of my clients are later diagnosed at this point. And so I really can speak more from their perspective. And masking does come up in the conversation. And I believe it's because, you know, they've been trying to put on the face that is going to make other people happy.
Right.
Performing, if you will. So that can be in school. Like, how can I please my teachers? What is it that they want from me? What do my peers want from me? And that's a really, you know, formidable time. And so we just kind of carry that with us.
That's such a neurodivergent phrasing, though, because you have generally like the fight or flight, which yes. comes up a lot. But when neurodivergence comes in, then you add the fawn. It's like fight, flight, or fawning. And I found that the people-pleasing aspect is a massive part of masking.
Absolutely, because being socially acceptable is like part of what, I mean, that's how we navigate life. And so especially when we're young and we're navigating relationships with peers and with teachers and with parents and the other adults in our lives. And moving into the adult world is not a whole lot different. We still have peers, coworkers. Sometimes coworkers aren't a lot different than middle school kids. You know, like if you don't fit in, they're gonna,
right.
You know, so we still have to behave in a certain way. We're still trying to please leaders and give them what they want. And so, and our partners. So we have that too. And so, yeah, there's a little bit, and it's like delicate word. It's very hard for me to describe, but it's just more of like, who are you? What are your passions? Let's bring more of that out. Let's take more time to just kind of have downtime and rest to get out of fight or flight, and then move more towards the direction of what excites you. And that often kind of helps them become more in tune with who they are. And when they're doing their passions, their hobbies, then they can put their mask down a little bit more and,
right.
and get to know themselves a little
bit. Is easy, I would say, to get overwhelmed. And I have to sometimes force myself to pause. Because if I'm in like overstimulation mode, I am going to react to a situation from a place of that overwhelm, of that overstimulation. If I could pause and take a breath, you know, just kind of pause and sit back for a minute, then I'm able to respond, which is, you know, it's calculated. It's, you know, responding from a place of reason as opposed to reacting from a place of emotion. But that's a really, that's something that I would say I had to learn, you know, learn through the years, through quite a bit of, you know, trial and error as far as trying to figure out what works in what situation, which one doesn't. And a lot of times it would be different masks. You know, I would wear one mask when I was in a social situation versus another one when I was in like work mode. So it's almost like putting on these different personas, which is really, you know, that I want to tie that into one of the reasons I really wanted you on this, on the site side is as I was looking through some of your background. What really jumped out to me is how you work with, you know, ADHD autistic professionals who are high performing until suddenly they're not. And that actually made me laugh out loud because that's like that speaks to my ADHD side in so many ways because I will be all about something until that novelty wears off, until the shine wears off. The second it stops being novel and starts becoming a chore, then suddenly, you know, the performance drops, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in a hobby, whether it's doing, you know, friendships, a lot of things have, you know, it'll have like a shelf life, so to speak. So I want to dive into that a little bit with your, you know, how you came up with that phrasing and what you do, you know, how you apply that in your work.
I would say often, so here are some of the things that my clients come with that is like, it's like kind of the last thing that pushes them over the edge. And so they've been holding it together for as long as they can. And then there's one more thing that pushes them over the edge. And then suddenly they're not. And so in the workplace environment, then they suddenly start dropping balls, or they're a little bit more emotional, or the overwhelm kind of thing, which leads to heightened emotions. They can look like anger and frustration, or it can also look like tears. Not like it can look a lot of different ways, but it's just like emotional meltdown. And it's just that one more thing that pushes them over the edge. So people come to me because they are having challenges with partners. It might be there's something going on with their kids. It might be I have people who have going back to grad school. And so now they've got one more thing. And it might be, you know, because of perimenopause, I'm getting women in their late 40s who are going through perimenopause. It's just like the next thing has pushed them, and then it all just kind of falls apart. And then that's it. And it's just like all the systems that they had in place to hold it together, like, it's just not anymore. And when that's happening, you just exactly said at the beginning, it's like managing the overwhelm. And so what we do, and this is what I encourage leaders to do, whoever is supporting these people in the workplace, this is the work we do in coaching, is like taking a step back. Because even now I'm thinking about it, I just have to like take a deeper breath to slow myself down. Because what we want to do is jump in, like that's our initial reaction. And be like, well, let's try this. But what we really need to do is slow down and get a little bit more in control of our emotions. So like you said, pause and breathe. And that's where we start, is that throughout the day. So we'll get like these little tiny 1 or 2 minute mindfulness practices, and we'll do several of them until we find the one or two that really resonate with you. And then we just schedule them all throughout the day, like 4 times a day, to just pause and slow yourself down. Because we get into these cycles of like, if I just keep going and going and going, I'll stay on top of it. And that doesn't work. It all just kind of gets kind of crazy and fuzzy in the brain. And that's what leads to overwhelm. So what we actually have to do is build in time to slow down, just like you said. And that's where we start.
Okay. Let me add, because you work with both. You work with both leadership, you know, management, and you work with, you know, actual employees. So let's, I'm interested to hear your perspective on this. So let's say we have a situation where there is an actual executive function breakdown. Okay. Someone's, you know, they're doing something they're on Excel doing spreadsheets, and suddenly they just get overwhelmed and have a meltdown. You know, they're crying uncontrollably, they're shaking, they get up and run. You know, a lot of times they'll run and go to a different, you know, safe space, locked in the bathroom. You know, could, you know, it's different for everyone, but it is a, let's say that it is a threshold moment. Okay. It's something that causes a disruption. Obviously other people in the workplace are going to notice. When you are talking about that situation, how would you frame it, both when you're talking to the person, you know, the client actually having the meltdown, versus when you're explaining it to their supervisor or manager? Same situation, but you're looking at it through two different lenses. Could you walk me through what those conversations would look like?
Yeah. And I mean, I can just give you the best that I can. Again, it's just on a case by case basis.
Right,
like,
right.
What are the people giving me? But generally, it looks like this. There's education for leadership. So what is ADHD? What is autism? And this sort of like emotional side of that, that is gaining more attention, but is underappreciated. So this is actually part of it. And that's what's happened, is they've just been pushed to the limit. Actually, we all of us know what it is like to be pushed to the limit and we lose it. So we can start from that. We know what it's like to be in times of stress for whatever reason, whether it's financial or family issues or health or whatever. We all know that then we have a shorter fuse. So if we can start from there, then we can see actually someone is running at that heightened level all the time. So then we can maybe just start to relate to their experience of being just a little bit more escalated all the time. It might be because of the social expectations of the environment. It might be because of the sensory sensitivities that they have. I mean, just so many things that they're running at a higher level. Okay, so if we can appreciate that, then we can understand why they're a little bit quicker to lose it than maybe other people. And what they need is more breaks. We're all really good at being like, this is it. I can't take it. I'm out of here. We just like lay on the computer chat and take off. We all do that. But what if we took more breaks more often? Then we can just kind of constantly be bringing ourselves down. So that's where I would start that conversation with leadership. If I were talking to that person who had just lost it, we would probably walk through like, what are the things that led up to that? Because sometimes people miss it and they see that last trigger and they were like, that was the thing that threw me over the edge.
Never the big thing. It's all, you know, you always trip over the pebble in the path. You don't trip over the mountain. It's always the little things. And it's
exactly,
it's always the little things. And it's like, it's a chain of little things. Like, you'll be going to work, yes, and you get stuck behind some purpose of going 5 miles an hour under the speed limit. And that slows you down enough to get stuck at every single red light on the way there. So then you stop to get coffee and you're standing in line at 7-Eleven behind a woman who's getting, you know, lottery tickets and buying numbers for every number there is, you know, kids' birthdays, grandbaby's birthdays, great grandbaby's birthdays for like 15, 20 minutes is buying lottery tickets. So you have all these little frustrations. And then it just, you know, then it just boils over. you trip over the pebble.
Yeah. And so I, you know, last night I was at the grocery store and there's an older woman working the register who's clearly new there and doesn't understand the systems. As I age, I'm learning that I learn slower and I'm frustrated because I'm like, come on, this is supposed to go faster. And then, so what we do is we recognize, wait a minute, why, like I am escalating and we don't notice those. We are so busy moving so fast that we don't notice the escalations until it's too late. And so I actually have a system that I teach, this sort of color regulation system that is like kind of based on the stoplights, green, yellow, orange, red, and we can kind of see ourselves escalating. And when we can notice that, that out of the reactionary part of our brain and more into the decision-making part of our brain, and we can get a little more rational. And then that helps us to calm down. So that's kind of where we start. Like we start looking at the pebbles along the way. We start noticing the escalation. We start building this color chart of so that you can understand what triggers you and what brings you back down. And we kind of do that whole process together over time so that you can be a little more in tune with yourself.
Right. Well, that's important. And that's where the workplace accommodations come into play, which is a major, you know, it's providing, like we touched on earlier, that structure, the scaffolding for an employee to be successful in the workplace, especially with neurodivergence. There's going to have to be some, some give and take. You know, they're able to produce at a high volume, in many cases, a little bit, you know, they can outproduce neurotypical peers, provided the accommodations are in place. And, so you mentioned that with, you know, more frequent breaks. Another one is, ambient lighting. Most everyone I know on the spectrum, we hate that overhead light. You know, I'm not a fan of overhead lighting. Anything, a nice, lamp somewhere, more ambient lighting is a huge one. Another common one is comfortable clothing. You know, maybe they're not comfortable in the, business casual of, polo shirt tucked into khakis or whatever. Maybe they need to wear a hoodie. Maybe they need, sweatpants or something that's a little more, not quite as restrictive. And these are minor things that a lot of them are strictly aesthetics, too. That's another thing. It's like really, outside of like the breaks, maybe, which might break up the workflow, it's really not that big of a concession to have ambient lighting or to let someone wear more comfortable clothing.
Yes. I talked to a guy one time that was like, the chair that I sit in can make or break my ability to pay attention. And he'll bring his own chair.
Right.
He needs to have that chair. So now if we're talking about open work environments with people who have, don't know where they're going to work that day, like that's completely disruptive. But the chair can matter. The sounds can be incredibly distracting. The smells can be incredibly distracting. They're just, and then if like we just think about how work gets done and what it looks like. And often someone who's neurodivergent isn't, it doesn't have consistent energy throughout the day or even day to day or week to week. And so it's like they can be incredibly hyper-focused and efficient for this period of time. And then it looks different a little while later. And so we look at them and their ability and the work that they produce as a whole, as opposed to like every day is the mouse moving enough times or are they, whatever. And so there are a lot of things that are very easy to do, but we get so rigid and what it's supposed to look like and how we're supposed to behave and all this that we are losing, really great people.
Right. It is. Well, I'd say that it is it is an issue. I don't know any of my peers who are, late diagnosed neurodivergent individuals who don't have haven't had some type of career tumultuation along the way. You know, most of us have jumped. Yeah. And it's a problem. I know unemployment is a severe problem with the neurodivergent community. I wanted to jump into the concept of masking fatigue. I know that this is something that you work with. And for listeners who might not know the term, can you explain like what this is and how you feel it would affect how it feels shows up at work, affects performance?
Yeah. So I think if we can go back to the example of like, you know what it's like. So someone who's neurotypical, you know what it's like to be dealing with a challenging situation in your life and holding it together at work. And it's very, very hard. So we can start from there because that's what you're doing. You're like putting on a good show, like, nope, I got this, even though whatever's going on in my life. And so now imagine that someone is holding it together because of overwhelm all the time, their whole lives, because of sensory issues. Also, the baggage that you carry from having these challenges your whole life. So the rejection sensitivity dysphoria, like what is that? And we'll, you know, we can explain what that is to the leadership, that kind of thing. Okay, so that's a little bit about masking. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question.
Oh, I was just asking about how the masking fatigue would, you know, show up in work. Oh. I think we kind of touched on it with the first, I would call it like the first cracks in the dam. You know, they're producing at a high level, and then we get onto that cusp where they were doing well until they weren't. So they start missing deadlines. They start coming to work a little bit late. They're not as present. And there's a noticeable change in whatever metrics they're being measured against for job performance.
Yep. All of those things. And then if you're their supervisor, you might, you know, be asking them to pick it up a little bit or, you know, well, like, just, you know, schedule time block your day differently or whatever. And so you'll kind of give them these vague things. And that is, they are going to have access to that until they're in a comfortable space to admit that they are burned out or burning out. And then we go all the way back to times of break and rest and slowing down. I had a client who was kind of like, this is the process that we went through. Like, we're going to slow down here. We're going to get some baseline systems back into place. He's like, I don't have time for that. I am so far behind and I'm stressed and I'm freaking out and everything. Here's the other side. I was like, let's prioritize. And he's like, I can't prioritize. Everything feels urgent and important. So if you get out the Eisenhower matrix and you're like, let's plot things, what is like urgent and important? He's like, everything is urgent and important. That's when we know we got to go all the way back and slow down because he is so overwhelmed. He can't even slow down and like make decisions about where priorities fall.
That's actually really brilliant because as you were saying that, it made me think of what you were talking about as far as that color code for slowing down in the moment. Maybe you could apply that same rubric to prioritization of workplace tasks, you know, like all like professional triage, so to speak, like what is absolutely mission critical? What can you do, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of the week, end of the month? So maybe that would definitely work because as a, you know, especially when I get caught up in my ADHD side, everything has to be done right now. There's no sense of that prioritization. It's just like you see things that need to get done. You want to do all of it at once. And that leads to extreme burnout.
Yes. Yeah. And then it becomes this giant list. And then you're like, I don't even know what to do with this list. So the first thing I want to say before we come back to the giant list is I've had people use that color chart. They end up using it for all aspects of their lives. So that's, once you get started with it, it's amazing what I have seen clients do with using it. So I really recommend messing around with it and seeing where it takes you. And then if you come back to the giant list, then we can kind of start to break it apart and be like, now that you're a little bit calmer, you can see which are the red ones. These ones have to be taken care of. Which ones are way down on the list? And then eventually we just go, you know what? I think they're probably just going to go away on their own. And so we can tear them off and throw them away. But really, it's got to be starting with the you know, getting yourself back to some semblance of calmer in order to be able to see it all.
It's executive function. That's what this comes down to. You know, planning, prioritizing, initiating, follow through is huge. My ADHD side is not medicated, I'm a, you know, three inning ball player. You know, I'm really, really great at planning and starting tasks and the follow through. Once we cross that threshold from it being fun and novel to being a chore, then it really falls down. You know, then it's just not, there's just not that follow through. So I, in the vein of executive function, what's different about how you would approach this with one of your neurodivergent clients versus just generic, you know, these generic platitudes or generic productivity advice?
Yeah. And so the generic productivity advice, I kind of encourage my clients to just throw out the,
right.
You know, right. Things like do the hardest thing first. For someone who has problems with task initiation, which the amount of energy that it takes to get started on something, which someone who has ADHD or autism, like that can be really hard. So then looking at a daunting, hard task, like, no, that's not going to work. Got to start with something that you can get some momentum. So something easier. So throw, you know, eating the frog or doing the hardest thing, throw that out the window. And then there's like the 2 minute rule. If it's only going to take 2 minutes, like just go ahead and stop and do that. Absolutely not for someone who has ADHD, because 2 minute ideas are constantly popping into your head. So absolutely not. Those need to go on a list and you schedule time to check all your 2 minute things off and you stay focused. So like all the productivity advice, I kind of just throw it out the window. And we just start with like, let's just start with time blocking. Time blocking is the thing is good. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that you need extended periods of time and then you just kind of leave them open. And then we, you know, look at your to-do list and we go, what is the highest priority here? And we get them in those time blocks. Then sometimes we have to talk about like, how do we even just get started on a task? And so we'll move into that. How can you stay focused when you're getting pulled away? How do we monitor your energy level? Because just because you said there was a hard thing that was going to happen at this time, your energy level isn't up for it. Okay, let's just move. Let's have flexible time blocks. So we move things around based on your energy. And so I just give them permission to let go of all the productivity advice that you've heard. And like, let's just build something that works for you. And for leadership, if you want to do this with them, just because it's worked for 2 weeks doesn't mean it's going to stick. I often work with my clients for 9 months because, yep, it's just like you said, it's all shiny and great and it's working. And then there's a wrench and it's like, okay, it starts to fall apart. We need to get back together again and reevaluate and pick back up again and then kind of plow through until it becomes part of the norm. And this takes time. And this is where I think leadership maybe misses it. They're like, oh, you've been doing it for 2 weeks. You're great. And then 3 months down the road, it's all falling apart again.
Right. It's that I think of that in my work. And I always think back to the Mike Tyson quote that everyone has a plan till they get punched in the face. Yeah. Because a lot of times it's, you know, plan sometimes doesn't survive first contact with, you know, unknown variables. So I feel like with these plans, especially with putting different strategies and things together, there has to be a certain amount of resilience built into it.
That's absolutely right. And so that's where the check in is like, oh, okay, I mean, that's not my plan. Like, it's going to be great for a few weeks. We're going to be like, yes, we got this. And then it's going to fall apart. And then that's where it gets hard. And that's where we have to kind of see it through. So without any kind of judgment, it's just what's going to happen. New systems don't stick. Like you said, the first side of a challenge, it's going to fall apart. And we got to like restart without judgment and get back on track and see it all the way through.
Right. Is this a, when you're dealing with leadership and whatnot, are they mostly open to this? Or do you ever deal with any friction on their end? Like they might see a employee who needs all these accommodations, especially if it's like a sudden diagnosis, like suddenly they have to make all these different accommodations. Do they ever, are they willing to work with you or do they ever see it as like a red flag? They're putting that employee on a PIP and just trying to, you know, maybe shuffle them out of the organization because they just don't want to deal with the headache.
I see a little bit of both. So it just depends on the kind of person. Like some people are really good at seeing the person and honoring them and what they need. And some people are like, if they can't follow the system, then it's not going to work. And so they're a little more hard-headed and unwilling to be flexible. They're the ones who just see, well, this is the way that it works. And so if you can't do it this way, then it's not going to work. And so, yeah, it just, you know, depends on the person.
I think it's because it would be different for every, you know, neurodivergent person, you know, because we want to tie together that sense of overwhelm. You know, where it requires that emotional regulation and that overwhelm comes with a masking fatigue when things are too much. But as someone who's had lived experience with this, I'm not even aware of it. It's like, you know, it's kind of macabre, but I'll use the frog metaphor. Okay. Let's say you want to, boil a frog to death. Okay. So you boil some water on the stove, you take a frog and you throw him in, he's going to leap out right away. But if you take tepid water and you fill up the pan with tepid water, put it on the stove and set the frog in, it's just going to sit there because it's just chilling. So then you turn up the heat gradually, you know, 1 degree a minute, 1 degree every few minutes. And after some time, the frog's going to die. It's going to be so comfortable and so unaware of what's actually happening that pretty soon it's in boiling water and it's dead. That's the best way I can explain what masking fatigue is, because it's going great until suddenly it isn't. And there isn't, you know, leadership or, you know, peers or anything. They'll say, oh, well, we didn't know anything was wrong. Why didn't you say anything? It's because we're maintaining that mask for so long. And that's like our default setting, is we need to keep up that appearance that we're holding it all together. I like to use the metaphor of a duck, for instance. You know, look at a duck. He's floating on top of the water. He looks so calm and serene, and he has it together. Meanwhile, under the surface, he's just pedaling for his dear life. And that's what masking is like. It gets tiring. So when we suddenly hit that overwhelm, it's like the more you struggle, the deeper you sink. It's like being in quicksand. You know, the more you fight against it, the faster you're drowning. And when that's coming up, I can understand where like leadership would have a difficult time seeing it, because all they're looking at is the duck. You know, they look at their employees and it's a bunch of calm ducks floating on the water, and they don't think anything's wrong. Meanwhile, then one dunks below the surface. You're like, oh, I had no idea. So what does that conversation look like? And this kind of opens our door to the next one, where we, you know, you're working with organizations and they sponsor coaching for employees. Okay. But when an organization is ready for that conversation, is that like after one of these breakdown moments happens?
Okay. Again, like most of the work that I do is with the individual. So I'll just give you from this the experience that I've had with, you know, supporting the leadership. And yeah, coaching within that is that it's like these are places and people who they feel comfortable having conversation. So I feel comfortable going to management or HR and saying, I have ADHD and I think this is why I'm just like drowning now. And so, yep, it often comes to that head where everything just kind of is falling apart. They're dealing with an incredibly stressed out employee who has always looked like they've been a nice little duck. And then all of a sudden it's come to a head. And it's like, then the people who are in support of this person, they realize they don't have the strategies to be able to coach them, because, you know, the typical like, well, let's just look at your planner or whatever it is it going to help? And then also these are people who understand that, yeah, they've got the employee assistance program that's going to give them 5 coaching sessions with some, you know, I don't know, some subscription that they have, but also recognizing that's probably not enough. And so they care about this person. They want them to do well. They see that it's just kind of not working right now. And they realize that the benefit is to get them some coaching, because otherwise this is just going to continue and they lose productivity from the person. And they have a stressed out person that they care about a lot. And it's eventually just going to go to a pip and they're going to lose them or whatever. And so that's where we get into the benefit of just bringing someone in as soon as you can to support them in working through this challenging time, whatever it is.
Right. And I think that's important, especially if they're informed leadership about neurodivergence. Because I feel like if they don't know what's going on and they're already like doing a PIP or trying to, you know, on the surface, trying to, you know, say employee retention, do a PIP or whatever. If that employee is already in masking fatigue, it's like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, it's already, you know, it's already done. So I think it's important to have that, you know, that sense of perspective from not only the employee, but also the leadership to understand that, hey, maybe there's a little bit more going on here. It's worth a, you know, worth a closer look. One of the things you talk about is, you'd say that this is, you know, cheaper than actually losing them, replacing them, or watching managers burn out. And what I wanted to ask you about is the return on investment argument, the ROI. So like, what would it actually cost an organization who are not actively supporting neurodivergent talent?
Yeah, well, for one, you have a struggling employee. So from purely financial or productivity, you're not getting the best from this person. And then as that continues for months, you're not getting the best of that person for months. And now you bring in team members because they're picking up the slack or, you know, whatever. So now you've got a frustrated team. That then goes to the management. So now you've got a manager who already has too much on their plate, who has a frustrated team, who has an employee who's struggling, and it falls on them. And they're like, I don't know what to do to fix this problem. So then it moves up to HR. HR tries to triage the whole thing. It's not working. So now you've just got all these people, this time, this money that's being invested because of this one person who's struggling ultimately leads to a PIP, and however long that, you know, runs out until eventually it ends in, you know, them asking them to leave or whatever. This whole thing requires so much time, energy, emotional resources, financial resources, where if you had intervened earlier when you saw that this person was struggling and had gotten them some personalized coaching and some support for management to support them or, you know, team. So we can do that as well. If we can get all that together, you can just save yourself so much time, emotional energy, stress, and money.
Right.
Because then you got to hire someone. And that is its full cycle of
right.
like time and energy and financial resources.
Training, and bringing them up to speed, training. Like it requires an investment on their part. No,
so I don't know how much that is, but I'm pretty sure.
Right. I feel like it would be organizational dependent, but it is. It definitely is more if it works more to their benefit to actually work with a neurodivergent talent rather than going through all the motions of getting.
Yeah. And if we can just look backwards for a minute, there's a reason that you hired them. They've been doing really great work for you up until this specific point. So let's just take action on this and be like, wait, I want that person back. They want that person back too. Like the employee wants to be that person. So what can we do to support them in getting back? And that might be some specialized coaching.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. It's one of the, I see it's pretty popular in the neurodivergent community. A lot of people self-identify as neurodivergent. And you see a lot of this self-diagnosis out there. Is that acceptable to company leadership, or would they rather see the, a formal diagnosis? If you can provide documentation, then especially with autism, they are protected under the ADA. So that company is legally required to give them accommodation versus someone who comes in and says, well, I think I have ADHD because I took an online test. Would you do this for me?
Yeah, I think you're going to probably have more success with the official diagnosis.
Right.
As opposed to the self-diagnosis. But then that's a double-edged sword. I spoke with a nurse at a public facility, a year or so ago, and she was talking about how, people think coming in to get a diagnosis is like, then I'm going to be able to present this to my employers and I'll be able to get accommodations. And they've actually been coached to really ask them to pause and consider that there are also some negative sides to that, because even though discrimination is illegal, it still happens. And so...
Well, it'll manifest in like microaggressions. For example, let's say you have an autistic employee who is, they can't deal with ambient noise. So they have noise canceling headphones on all the time. The company handbook specifically says no personal headphones at all. You can't listen to music at work. So you have a neurotypical employee who's going to say, oh, well, why does little Jimmy get his noise canceling headphones and we don't? It granted that is a, legally protected ADA mandated accommodation. At the same time, there's going to be that sense of envy. There's going to be that sense of resentment, and that's going to manifest in different microaggressions. And, neurodivergent people would deal with enough discrimination without having to pile on. So aside from having, leadership understanding about neurodivergent employees, would you like to see more neurodivergent awareness maybe given towards a whole, to the whole staff or the whole, all the workforce?
100%. And actually, about a year ago, that was really my primary focus, was education to leadership about neurodivergent. And so that was what I was trying to do, because I realized that if we go back to my teaching, I realized that my students were in their 30s at this point. And I was like, oh, wait, they still have ADHD. They still have autism. And the workplace doesn't understand their brain. And so, that was really what I set out, part of what I set out to do when I started this program. Unfortunately, in our current climate, DEI programs are kind of like fading or moved to the back burner or quiet. And so that really never gained momentum, but I still, have done a little bit of that. Now it's kind of more towards like, okay, working with when I do corporate sponsored coaching. So when the organization pays me to coach one of their employees, then I also have meetings with HR and their manager as well. Not necessarily to, give specific details of our coaching sessions, but to support them and understanding what is ADHD, what is autism. So now it just looks a little bit different, but absolutely, I think that education is needed for everyone.
Right. Okay, so if we have any, management, leadership, anyone who's listening to this podcast, and they have someone on their team who fits this pattern of neurodivergence, capable, but they're struggling, what would you say the first step is?
I think the first step I would say to them is, and I mean, it sounds a little like, I don't know, you know, get to know the person, which I mean, just makes sense. And so let's see if I can be a little more descriptive, because again, every person is so unique, but don't jump in with strategies because they've tried them all. Everybody who struggles with executive functions and productivity, they've tried all the strategies out there and it hasn't worked. And when I'm working with clients, I just kind of start that with like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to try a strategy. I'm going to throw something out there and you're going to tell me why it's not going to work for you. And we're going to brainstorm. We're going to keep going until you go, yeah, okay, think that makes sense. I can try that. All right. And then you're going to come back to me the next week and you're going to be like, here's why it didn't work, because I don't expect it to work. And then we're going to like iterate on that. And we're like, okay, so let's, and we're just going to brainstorm until we get something that works. And I see
I'm loving that. Well, I'm loving that because that's one of the things I deal with my consulting firm is neurodivergent processing and applied neurodivergences. We are very, very good at peeking around the corner and knowing whether something's going to work or something's not going to work. So I love that approach because you come to the client and you're like, well, this is what we're going to do. Why is this problematic? And they're going to give you they're going to tell you exactly why it won't work and be detailed about it. So then you're like, okay, well, let's try this angle. Let's try that angle. And I love that you're working with the people to find an independent solution because that, again, talks to the, you know, our concept of the neurodivergent processing where we do the, you know, bottoms-up processing. It's part of the neurodivergent, you know, cognition. Whereas leadership wants to apply that one size fits all, you know, the top down, okay, we're going to give everyone a Covey planner, use your planner, and that's going to do it. It might work for everyone because it's top down, but it's not going to work from the bottom up. So you're coming to your client and allowing them to use their own processing ability to, you know, curate their own, you know, their own work environment, their own system of success, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah. So I guess maybe that was, so maybe that's where I would, now that I've talked through it a little bit, that's how I would help leadership start is just be like, I bet this probably isn't going to work because you've tried a lot of things, but let's start here. Why don't you tell me how this may or may not fit into what you're doing and then come back and tell me all the reasons that it didn't work and we'll just refine. And I've got an example of that. You know, I do a lot of work with calendars. Everybody's got their online calendar. And I'm like, I think everybody needs to go back to a wall calendar. And, you know, I get people working with whiteboard calendars and sticky notes and they're moving things around. Or I've got someone who's got three different calendars with three different aspects of their life on whiteboards on the wall. And it's like, just so many different ways to work on this one challenge based on the needs of the person and their specific job requirements and just the way that their brain works and get creative. It's kind of fun.
Right. Well, I agree. It's just that it has to be individually tailored, curated, so to speak. Because it can't, you know, there's not going to be a one size fits all. It's like, you know, and that's one of the things we deal with in the neurodivergent community as far as there's no one size fits all approach. If you've met one person with autism, you have met one person with autism. You know, there's not going to be any, you know, we're all different and we all express it in different ways because it's a spectrum. It's not a one size fits all approach. Okay, so, you know, to start wrapping this up, what is one thing that you would want neurodivergent professionals to know, especially those who are, you know, just late diagnosed, late identified, and who are just now figuring this out?
Number one, I would say to check in on your own inner critic. This is the part where you now need to look backwards and say, just as you had said previously, oh, that was an autistic thing. So when you saw it pop up when you were in, you know, high school or middle school or with your, you know, whoever you were at home with, your parents or the other adults or early in your career, like look back on some of those things and start to forgive the judgment that you put on yourself for whatever that was. And so get to know this inner critic who is constantly telling you that you screwed up and become more friendly with it and more forgiving of it. So some of the work that I do is like mindfulness. So like, let's recognize what's going on in our head. Let's become a little more friendly and form a relationship with this person that's always been judging us because other people were. So we got some mental health work to do here. And then Secondly, then a lot of my clients just want to dive in. There's so much information out there now about ADHD and autism. And there are so many influencers and people with, you know, all this information out there. Just, you know, pick one or two people that you really like and just kind of stick with them and go slow, because too much information then becomes one more overwhelming thing. Like, are you going to start with diet? Are you going to start with meds? Are you going to start with therapy? Are you going to start with coaching? Like, there's just so much. So just pick, you know, one or two people that really resonates with you, books or podcasters or influencers of some kind, and just start with them, or get a coach and then just turn it completely over to them. Be like, help me, help walk me through this. And then, you know, if you don't know where to start, just reach out to me and I'll get you some resources. I'm happy to offer that to anyone. I can give you my favorite podcast. I can give you my favorite diet. I can give you my favorite newsletter, all those things, and just take it slow.
Absolutely. I love that, you know, find something and stick with it, because that's so counterintuitive to the ADHD approach. Cause they're going to want to do, I know, cause I'll do it. You know, if you spot it, you got it. I'll try to do everything at once. And suddenly I have like 200 tabs open on my computer and no, you know, I don't have any, you know, I haven't learned anything. So that's actually a really, really good piece of advice. I love that. So what is one thing that you would want organizational leaders to know?
I would say for them, you know, the next app, the next productivity tool, the next calendar, the next planner, or the next program isn't the thing. It's not, people with ADHD will say one more notebook's going to solve my problem. and it's not. And so just like, kind of, what system are they trying to use? And how can you just start to brainstorm with them revisions to it to make it stick, and then check in later? And if it looks like it's kind, they've lost their way, we don't need to grab the whole thing. Come back. Be like, wait a minute, let's just come back to this. It looks like you've lost your way. This, we developed this. It's got to work. It was working before. I call it hitting a reset button. Like, imagine like one of those big red buttons that you can hit, hammer down and be like, we're going to reset. Like, we've fallen off. We're going to reset. I'm not judging you. You need to not judge you. We're just going to come back to what works. And then we need to do that over and over until it really sticks.
Right. Those resets are so important. It's always, you know, there's a saying in recovery that it's never too late to restart your day. And it's really, you know, it could really just reset. And it's, and that's another thing. It's, it comes down to, you know, moments, you know, like personally, I don't believe there's any such thing as having a bad day. Okay. You might have a series of bad moments. Like we talked about at the start of the podcast, you know, it's the little things, you know, have this little series of bad moments that leads to a massive, massive meltdown. But at the end of the day, you might say you had a bad day, but it was only like maybe two or 3 minutes of just really bad moments. And you're focusing on that instead of the whole. So it's really important to maintain a sense of perspective about things. And remember that you can reset. It's never too late. Never too late to reset your day. Okay, so lastly, what? Where can people find you? You know, neuroautonomy, what's the best way of getting a hold of you?
I do most of my social media work on LinkedIn. So you can find me there, Jeannie Love. I have a pretty unique name, so don't.
Okay, I'll put it in the show notes. I'll drop your link in the show notes.
Fantastic. And then my website, neuroautonomy. So just like having autonomy over the way that your brain works. So neuroautonomy.com. And then, you know, if you want to chat, I offer, you know, a discovery call for anybody who wants to pick my brain. And I'm not super salesy to sign up for coaching if it doesn't seem like the right time or thing for you. So, you know, feel free to just book a call. You can email me or send me a message on LinkedIn, whatever. I'm happy to help you out.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, in closing, do you have any parting shots? Anything else you want the audience to know?
Let's see. If you are finding out that you have ADHD later in life, whether it's an official diagnosis or a self-diagnosis, slow down. Journal. Have people write just like whatever thoughts are going on in your head, especially if there's a lot going on in your head right now. Just get on paper. That helps to quiet things down and give you a little bit more perspective. And then just take some step backs to recognize that you have been dealing with this your whole life, and that you have some rejection sensitivity because of it, and
we're going to start to kind of let go of that critic. And for leadership, know that they're going through that process and that, you know, whatever has worked to get you where you are is probably not going to be the thing that's going to help them. And so we got to get creative, brainstorm, and just keep iterating until we find something that works to support them. Because you'd have a really great employee if we meet them where they are. This is what I like to say. They've been working their whole lives to meet us where we want them to be, like where the teachers want them to be, their family, the adults, you know, whatever. But maybe we can meet them a little bit more where they are and get a little more creative in supporting them. And then that will be a really great relationship.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm sorry we only had an hour. I mean, this one probably could have strung out to 2 or 3 hours. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to another episode of The Site Side. We'll be back on Thursday with another episode. And thank you again. Have a wonderful day.